for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. William Friedkin is best known for directing The French Connection and The Exorcist. The Academy Award-winning director has written a new memoir titled The Friedkin Connection. In it, he tells of his upbringing by Ukrainian immigrants in Chicago and his decades-long career in film and now opera. William Friedkin joins me in this studio. You are welcome to be part of the conversation. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to you, sir. It's so good to have you here.
What a great pleasure to be on this program, Diane.
Thank you.
And to meet you.
Now, do you prefer being called
Billy?
Bill.
Bill or Billy is fine. That's what everyone calls me.
You know, I'm interested. You call this a memoir, but it's not necessarily chronological. You simply steeped yourself in your own memories.
That's correct. Much like Marcel Proust, but not as good. I got a phone call one day about almost 4 years ago from an agent in New York called Richard Pine. And I didn't know him. He got my number through a mutual friend, and he asked me if I'd be interested in writing a memoir. And I said, no. And he said, well, why not? And I said, because I wouldn't be interested in reading it. He said, what if I were to tell you I had five publishers that would be interested in publishing you?
Huh.
I said, well, that would get my attention.
Yeah, of course.
So I went back to New York, met with them, and there was a man at HarperCollins who's now the publisher who gave me sort of the key as to how to do it, because I didn't know how to do it. I had never kept diaries throughout my career. And what he said was, don't write a book where you just say this happened and this happened and this happened.
Right.
Write about how you felt about everything important that happened to you. And that's what I set out to do.
So did you do it a moment that became vivid to you?
Yes, I just sat down somewhere or stood up somewhere, and I would allow my imagination to roam freely throughout what I could recall from my over 77 years, and things would come to me, you know, out of thin air. And I wrote the book in longhand over 3 years, and things would come to me. I'd write about them until I couldn't remember anymore, and then move to something else, which might have been 30 years later or 20 years before. And then occasionally I'd remember more about those times and go back and write some more.
So was there a lot of editing?
Well, I wrote the book in longhand, and then when I'd get 50 pages at a time, I would read those into a microcassette recorder.
Good for you.
Get them typed, and they'd come back in about 34 pages, and I'd rewrite those 7 or 8 times, and that would take them to about 27 pages, and I'd send those to my editor.
That's terrific. Did you approach filmmaking in the same way?
Pretty much instinctively.
Really?
I approached filmmaking. I never had a lesson in filmmaking. I never went to college. I went from... Oh, you too?
Me too.
Yeah. Well, we don't want to say that too loud, though, do
we,
Diane?
Well, we share a great deal.
I know. But the thing is, I never read a book through all the way through high school. I faked my book reports from classic comics. Do you remember those?
Of course.
And sometimes the classic comics were incorrect, and I turn in a book report and fail. So, but after high school, I went to work at a television station, radio TV station, WGN in Chicago, where I started in the mailroom and worked my way up.
Uh-huh.
And that's how you did it then, if you were a young man. But it was tougher for women. It was tougher for young women. They advertised for young men. you know, to start at an entry-level job. And after a year, I became a floor manager, which is like an assistant director. And then a year later, I was directing live television.
Extraordinary.
You know, it's all the mystery of fate.
Absolutely.
You know, I went to the wrong station to apply for this job. I tell you what happened. There was an ad in the newspaper asking for a young man who wanted a career in television to start in the mailroom. I went down there on a Saturday, not even knowing whether the mailroom would open or close. I went in. There was the guy who ran the mailroom. And he said, what are you doing here, kid? And I said, well, I've come to apply for the job. And he said, well, tell me about yourself. And that took about 30 seconds, you know. And he said, all right, you seem like a nice enough kid. Here's what you do. And he showed me, and he said, you can start on Monday. And I said, well, thank you, sir, $33 a week. And as I was leaving, he said, by the way, kid, are you stupid? And I said, well, what do you mean, sir? He said, take a look at that ad that brought you here. And I looked at it, and I said, yeah. He said, what address is on that ad, and what station? I said, it's WBBM Television at 446 North Michigan. He said, well, this is WGN Television at 441 North Michigan. You've come to the wrong place.
It's all fate.
It's all Had I gone to the right station,
exactly,
I might not have been hired.
You and I share so much. But one thing we really share is growing up listening to radio, radio drama, Lux Radio Theater, The Shadow, The Green Hornet. Fabulous.
Suspense. Yeah.
Fabulous.
Inner Sanctum.
How did listening to radio, do you think, affect your move into how you began directing?
Well, from the time I started directing and right up to the present day, I view the soundtrack in a completely different way from the picture. And I do the soundtrack, all of it, afterwards.
Really?
All the effects, of course, the music. And I even loop a lot of the dialogue in order to improve performance. That is, I replace the dialogue with someone sitting quietly in a studio like this and being able to emphasize different words or thoughts. Dramatic radio was the most powerful medium to me because it used your imagination. It wasn't all up there on a screen. It was all done through the human voice and sound effects and music. And I still remember some of these programs, they had such a profound effect on me, and they taught me how to create suspense and use the imagination. Now, quickly, you lose that because motion pictures now show you everything. But I still try to use the imagination. I still try to layer the sound into my films.
So why do you believe the French Connection was so revolutionary?
I have no idea. I thought it was a little B picture, a little cop film. I think one thing that was different about it was that the two detectives, and this has been a theme of mine throughout all of my work, it was about the good and evil in all of us, including those two detectives that broke the case, and the thin line between the policeman and the criminal. And these two detectives who I met in real life seemed to me to reflect that, which is what I believe about people. I believe it's a constant struggle for our better angels to survive and thrive. And so these two cops were not, as I portrayed them, just heroes, which is how they saw themselves. But I saw them as flawed people dealing with other flawed people.
You've said in the book that Citizen Kane was one of the most profound movies for you.
Oh, yes, and for many other people as well. It's generally thought of as the greatest American film by historians and film critics. It was never a success, never a financial success. But it was a quarry for filmmakers. I mean, it's the most incredible use of the camera and dialogue and music and editing and lighting. It was all there at its very best, much like Beethoven's Fifth Symphony.
Why do you think it wasn't a financial success?
Too intelligent, way over people's heads. It wasn't the common fare, even back in 1941 when it was released.
They weren't ready for it.
People are more interested in pure entertainment who go to movies.
Musicals.
Well, I love the musicals. I loved the Hollywood musicals. I wish I had directed the Hollywood musicals. But by the time I became a director, they were done. No more Gershwins, no more Cole Porter, no more Fred Astaire or Gene Kelly or Sid Charisse or Ann Miller. The zeitgeist had changed, and I sort of drifted mostly over to the dark side because the American musicals, which I wish I had made, were no more.
William Friedkin, we're talking about his new memoir, The Friedkin Connection. And when we come back, we'll talk more. We'll hear a few excerpts from films and take your calls. Stay with us. If you've just joined us, the brilliant director William Friedkin is with me. His new memoir is titled The Friedkin Connection. Why on the cover do you have your hand partially covering your face?
Diane, I don't even know who took that picture on the cover. I think it was done at a press conference. So I have not looked at the photo credit, if there is one. I believe it was at a press conference that I did somewhere in Europe several years ago.
Jacket designed by Christine Van Brie, jacket photograph, Dennis Ruvra, Corbis outline.
Have no idea what that is. It looks like, even though I seem to be looking into the camera lens, which I'll often do when they take my picture, but it looks like it was done at a press conference in Italy.
When you were listening to a question.
Exactly.
Perhaps.
Exactly. But I didn't choose either the title of this book or that photograph. That was done by the publisher. I wanted to call the book simply Connections because it really is about all of the various people that I met along the way and how I learned something or moved to another level as a result of knowing these people.
Why did you choose to do the movie The Exorcist.
Because it's one of the most powerful stories I've ever heard of. And it took place in Silver Spring, Maryland. It's based on an actual case that took place in 1949 in Silver Spring, Maryland. And it was a 14-year-old boy, not a 12-year-old girl. It's on the front page of the Washington Post then. Your audience can Google it and read about the 49 exorcism case in Silver Spring, and it gives many of the details. Bill Blatty, who wrote the novel, was an undergraduate at Georgetown when this case took place, and he tried to write about it factually, but he couldn't get any information about it other than what was in the Washington Post, and even though he went to Georgetown University.
Look, I'm only against the possibility of doing your daughter more harm than good.
Nothing you can do could make it any worse.
I can't do it. I need evidence that the church would accept as signs of possession.
Like what?
Like her speaking in a language she's never known or studied.
What else?
I don't know. I'd have to look it up.
I thought you were supposed to be an expert.
There are no experts. You probably know as much about possession as most priests. Look, your daughter doesn't say she's a demon. She says she's the devil himself. Now, if you've seen as many psychotics as I have, you'd realize that's the same thing as saying you're Napoleon Bonaparte. You asked me what I think is best for your daughter. 6 months under observation in the best hospital you can find.
You show me Reagan's double. Same face, same voice, everything. And I'd know it wasn't Reagan. I'd know in my gut. I'm telling you that that thing upstairs isn't my daughter. Now, I want you to tell me that you know for a fact that there's nothing wrong with my daughter except in her mind. You tell me you know for a fact that an exorcism wouldn't do any good. You tell me that!
And, of course, that is the voice of Ellen Burstyn playing the part of the mother, Chris McNeil, speaking to a priest played by Jason Miller. Even that tiny excerpt gives me the chills.
Yes, it is chilling. And most people, well, as I say, it is based on one of only three cases that the Catholic Church authenticated in the United States up till that time period. I haven't followed it since. But they did an exhaustive investigation on this young man, and they believed that an exorcism was not only possible but necessary. And the young man was healed of whatever these afflictions were, and he's back in normal life today and has no memory of what happened to him in 1949.
This is a question from, here it is. This is from Philip, who said, I think that Bill Friedkin invented projectile vomiting, but I'm hesitant to expand this line of inquiry.
Not guilty. I'm not sure what he means by that. That kind of physical discomfort that led to almost constant vomiting was part of the manifestations that this young man underwent. And everything that you see in the film is in the diaries that I've read from Georgetown. They're in the Catholic diocese in the Washington, D.C. area. And Father Robert Henley, who was president of Georgetown before I made the film, let me read the diaries of not only the priests who were involved, but the doctors, nurses, and some of the patients at Alexian Brothers Hospital in St. Louis, where the exorcism was performed.
Did you ever meet the young man himself?
No, the church didn't want that to happen. I spoke to his aunt at great length, and she told me some incidents that weren't even in Blatty's book that I put into the film.
Such as?
Well, the furniture moving around the room, the dresser pushing itself in front of the door to block the door so that people couldn't get out. I hesitate to talk about this stuff, Diane, because people find it hard to believe, as did I, until I read these accounts, and they were either having to do with mass hallucination or demonic possession.
And what about the head spinning?
That's something I believe that Blatty invented, but there were other similar things that occurred. Superhuman strength, levitation, contortionism that was similar to the head spinning. But Blatty, who did not have the facts, but only the story as it was written in the Washington Post, and then his religious instructor at Georgetown, Father Eugene Gallagher, brought other information that he had because he knew the exorcist in St. Louis, who was a Father William Bowdern. But almost everything else occurred. Everything that Blatty included, and I included in my book, I quote from the diaries at great length. Now, I happen to believe, as I think as Hamlet said to his friend Horatio, there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy, Horatio. And that's how I approach life. I do not approach life as a cynic. I believe in the teachings of Jesus, although I'm not a Catholic or a Christian. But I believe that the teachings of Jesus are, you know, almost impossible to live up to. But I approach a lot of things that most people would simply doubt. I approach them as possible.
Did you ever, during the filming of The Exorcist, worry for yourself or the young people involved?
I never worried for myself. I was much more concerned about what effect this film would have on the young girl who played the part. And she was the only girl out of thousands who auditioned that I felt could get through it, and she did.
She got through it. Did you follow her afterwards?
We're still good friends. She's now 52 years old.
And she's fine.
She's doing great. She's done more films and television programs than I have, and she was recently in the road company of the musical Grease. She's very active with PETA, you know, the organization that protects animals, and she's very active in that. That's her passion, and she still loves horses. You know, when I met her, she was winning blue ribbons showing horses at places like Madison Square Garden.
I love it. Now, French Connection won 5 Oscars in total, including Best Director, Best Picture, Best Actor. It grossed $52 million at the box office. How did you come to direct it?
Well, one thing is that $52 million would be almost $300 million in today's ticket price. But the producer brought it to me. I met him quite by accident. He had seen some of my documentary films, and I directed the very last Alfred Hitchcock Hour that was made after 9 or 10 years of that show. And he had seen some of these, and we started to talk and meet. And one day he told me about the French Connection case, and I was fascinated by it. We went back to New York from Los Angeles and met the two cops who broke the French Connection case, and I was fascinated by them and made the film more about them than the case.
And the case was, briefly?
It was $32 million worth of uncut heroin that came into the United States from Marseille, hidden in the rocker panels of a car. The rocker panels are just below the door. It's where you step up to get into the car. And what they were doing was peeling back these rocker panels, inserting the kilos of heroin in the rocker panels. They'd then close the rocker panels, ship the car to America, and then it would be bought in America, the drugs taken out of it, and cash put back in and shipped back to France.
And what you're trying to demonstrate in this film is not only that extraordinary story, but that thin line that police are involved in.
Well, the best cops think like criminals. And I've always felt there was a thin line between the policeman and the criminal. I mean, you have to understand the criminal mind to be an effective cop.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show.
All right, Popeye's here. Get your hands on your heads. Get off the bar and get on the wall. Come on, move. Move.
Come on, sweetheart, move.
Come on, move out.
All right, come on.
Hands face the window.
Move.
Face the wall. Turn around there.
Turn around.
Move. Come on, move.
Hands out of your pocket.
Turn around.
Come on, you heart. Come on.
Turn around, come big on, man. Come on, turn around. Get on the wall. Get on.
Get him up.
Turn around.
Get him up.
Turn around. Hey, you dropped that. Pick
all
it up.
Those hands up.
Pick it up. Come on, move.
What are you looking at?
All right, bring it here. Get your hands out of your pockets. What's my name?
Doyle.
What?
Mr. Doyle.
Come here. You pick your feet. You get over there. Get your hands on your head.
You had a hard time with Gene Hackman during that film. Why?
Well, Gene wanted to do that role. He really lobbied to get into the film. But then once I introduced him to Eddie Egan, the actual cop he was playing, he rode around with Egan, as I had done for months before I made the film. He thought that Egan was a racist. Gene came from a very small town in Illinois called Danville, and there was a lot of racism there when he was younger that he had to overcome. And the way he saw Egan operate, he was reminded of that kind of racism. I didn't see Egan that way. I knew that it was largely an act for him to survive in the streets, to treat people, including African-American people, that roughly as in the clip that you heard. And that's exactly how Egan would do it. Now, Gene and I clashed over the fact that I wanted to show how Egan operated, warts and all. But every African-American cop behaved the same way in the streets, or they would not have survived. So Gene and I had a lot of conflict, and I used his anger against me to get him into the mood of Popeye.
That's a brilliant director. Here's a question from Philip. Did Bill invent the urban car chase?
Not at all. A few years before The Chase and the French Connection, there was a very good chase in a film called Bullet with Steve McQueen, was shot in San Francisco. And I love Bullet. I think it's a really great detective film, but I wasn't all that crazy about the chase scene in Bullet. In studying it, I realized that they just cleared out the streets and ran the cars over the hills of San Francisco. And there was no sense of real danger to the pedestrians. So I knew when I made the French Connection, I had to do a chase because it was in New York, where innocent people were at risk. And that's what I set out to do. But before either the chase in Bullet or the chase I did in French Connection, there were the chases made by Buster Keaton in the silent film era that are spectacular. And your audience can see them now on DVDs restored. If I had seen any of those Buster Keaton scenes before I was to do a chase, I would never have done a chase.
Really?
They're that good.
Really?
They're amazing. And he not only created them, he acted in these scenes at great personal risk to himself
acted in
and directed them.
Wow.
And they're spectacular.
What about the car chase scenes in the Bourne films.
They're good. They're very good. They use, to a great extent, modern technology, which means computer-generated imagery. We didn't have that. We had to do everything, as did Keaton, live, mechanically.
How could you do that?
One shot at a time. Have you ever knitted, Diane? Have you ever done any knitting? Well, you've seen people knit.
Yeah.
Shooting a chase scene is very much like knitting. It's one shot at a time, as knitting is one stitch at a time. Knit one, purl two.
So how long does it take to do an entire chase scene?
It took me probably close to a month, but not on consecutive days to do the French Connection. I've done several others, but just as someone knitting has to envision the sweater before you knit it, you have to see the chase in your mind's eye.
William Friedkin, his new memoir is titled The Friedkin Connection. Short break, right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. By the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And by the John A. Hartford Foundation, working to improve the health of older Americans at jhartfound.org. This is NPR.
A few years ago, I was planning on killing myself in my garage, and now I'm doing the best thing I've ever done in my life in that same garage.
That's comic Mark Maron in a scene from his new TV series, Maron, talking about the popular podcast he records in his garage. Maron also has a new memoir. Maron talks about fights, apologies, dysfunction, and comedy on the next Fresh Air.
And if you've just joined us, William Friedkin is my guest this morning. Of course, he has made many, many prize-winning films, among them The Exorcist, The French Connection, and then, jumping forward, Killer Joe. Tell me about Killer Joe.
Killer Joe is originally a play written over 20 years ago by Tracy Letts, who's one of the best dramatists in this country today. He won the Pulitzer Prize and the Tony Award a couple of years ago for August Osage County. He is really a fine playwright in the league of Arthur Miller and Tennessee Williams. And he and I have the same worldview. And I saw Killer Joe, and I was immediately attracted to it because I recognized all the characters.
You're really attracted to dark stories.
I am now, but I told you earlier, Diane, I wish I could have done Gigi, American in Paris, The Bandwagon, Singing in the Rain. Those are my favorite films. I watched them over and over.
So what took you to the dark side.
They weren't making those kind of films when I became a director. And then my influences of radio drama, which you mentioned, were the kind of things I drifted toward in film, where audiences can watch sometimes pain and suffering and some of the most terrifying things, but they feel they're safe. It's called a safe darkness. When an audience goes into a theater to see The Exorcist, for example, they're obviously terrified or appalled by what's happening on the screen, but they know that when the lights come up, they can walk out of the theater, and that's not going to be a part of their lives. So they're drawn to that as a kind of release.
So you describe Killer Joe as a kind of catharsis.
It is, in a way. Killer Joe is the hardest-edged film I've ever made. It received an NC-17, which is the most restrictive rating. It's virtually censorship, the NC-17.
And why did you choose Matthew McConaughey?
I saw him being interviewed on a television show. I had never seen any of those romantic comedies that he became known for. I'd never seen one of them.
How about Time to Kill? Did you ever see that?
I didn't see that. I saw The Lincoln Lawyer just before I made Killer Joe. But I saw him being interviewed, and I realized that he was from the area in which the story is set, East Texas, and he had the right accent.
What are you? I mean, what do you do?
I'm a detective.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Like Magnum P.I.?
No. He's a private detective. I'm in the Dallas Police Department.
He ain't real either.
No. I'm real.
I read it's nothing like them shows with car chases and all.
A lot of paperwork.
I read some policemen go their whole lives without shooting their guns.
Probably true.
You ever drawn your gun?
Oh, sure.
You ever shot anybody?
Yes.
Who?
Nobody you'd know.
Did they die?
Well, they have. Yes.
Wow.
Now, here's an email about that movie, which says, my husband persuaded me to see Killer Joe with him, but we were both appalled by the violence, especially against women, and the sexual abuse of the young girl. What were Mr. Friedkin's reasons for making that film?
I thought that the sort of thing that's portrayed went on and goes on all the time. It is a story that is, in fact, based in truth. I personally am not a misogynist. I have never committed violence against any woman on any level, and I don't promote it. The characters in Killer Joe are not meant to be admired any more than the characters in Shakespeare's Scottish play are meant to be admired. But it's Shakespeare's way of saying, here is who they really are. They're murderers. And other of Shakespeare's plays are extremely violent and disturbing. Look at Hamlet's abuse of women, of his mother, of Ophelia. Hamlet is an abuser, a serial abuser, but it is a great piece of drama. And that's how I viewed Killer Joe. I'm sorry if people are offended. I don't set out to offend people, but neither do I set out to cover the truth.
Let's open the phones. 800-433-8850. First to Louisville, Kentucky. Good morning, Michael. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Mr. Friedkin, I've enjoyed your work for a long time. Congratulations.
Thanks very much.
I'd like you to talk a little bit about your film Bug and what inspired you to make that.
Again, it was written by Tracy Letts, and Bug is probably the most profound piece of writing that I've read about paranoia and how paranoia can be passed from one person to another who are in a very symbiotic relationship. And we see evidence of this all the time. This is about a kind of serial paranoia. And again, it's taken to extremes. But again, what drew me to that and to Killer Joe were what I thought were the underlying truths behind it. Because there should be many kinds of films. They can't all be stupid comedies or lame musicals. You know, there have to be a lot of films. And the films that I'm attracted to tend to be on the edge and on the dark side. I must say that.
And yet, here you are, now moving to opera. Tell us about that.
Number of years ago, it was 1996, Zubin Mehta, the renowned conductor, is a friend of mine. We always used to talk about either politics or movies or music. And one day he said to me, I was having dinner with my wife and Zubin and Nancy, his wife, and he said to me out of the blue, why don't you do an opera with me? And I said, gee, Zubin, I've never seen an opera. And he said, oh, come on. He said, we've talked about opera music. I said, yes, I've listened to some opera, but I've never seen one. He said, no, no, you'd be very good. And in order to put him off, he said, what would you do if you had the chance? And I knew he is the permanent musical director in Florence at the Maggio Musicale, the Florence Opera House. And in order to put him off, I said, well, I would do either one of the two Alban Berg operas. And Berg wrote Lulu and Wozzeck, and they're both atonal. And they were both written in the 20th century, which is not the great century for opera. And in Florence, in Italy, they don't care for German opera, even if it's good. You know, they don't like Wagner or Schoenberg, but or Berg. So I said, well, I would do either one of the Berg operas. And he went out of the room. He came back with his diary that had his bookings for about 7 years. And he said, okay.
He
leafed through it.
You down.
And he said, I'll do Wozzeck with you in 2 years if you commit to it now. And I was puzzled and disturbed. And my wife said, oh, go ahead. It'll be fun. And so I then steeped myself in it, and I studied German for a year.
Wow.
And learned the libretto. And by the time I came to do it, I had a concept. And I've now done about 15 operas since, all over the world.
How does it feel?
It's great. It's very similar to directing for film. The only difference is you don't have a camera, of course. But with film, you can emphasize a person or an object or something by the use of the close-up lens. With opera, you can do the same thing on the stage with the way you position people and light them. So you must have a concept. And then I found that of lighting and set. But I found that the great singers I've worked with, and I did two operas here for the Washington National Opera at Kennedy Center, I found that the great singers want the same thing that really fine actors want, which is a psychological underpinning for their characters and a staging that works.
So you are directing them as you would an actor in a film.
Yes, using sense memory, the way an actor does. In order for an actor to play any emotion, whether it be happiness, fear, sorrow, whatever it may be, they have to reach into their own experiences. And what the director does is find out what those aspects of their personality are so that you can push those buttons when you need to, in order to get them to reach down into their sense memories.
And what we have glossed over, forgive me for doing so, is your own upbringing, I want to hear about that and how that led you to, without college, without training, to become one of the great filmmakers in the world.
Well, you're too kind, but I think what's necessary for anyone to succeed in anything are really three things: ambition, luck, and the grace of God. That is my belief. You notice I didn't mention talent. There are many untalented people out there, you know, taking our hard-earned dollars all the time for stupid things that have no underlying meaning, nothing. They're just meant to put people in chairs and relieve them of their hard-earned cash. But I believe that I had a great deal of ambition and luck and the grace of God.
From your parents, luck.
Yeah, well, my parents weren't very ambitious. They both came from Kiev, Russia, in the Ukraine then. They both came over to the United States during a pogrom at the turn of the 20th century. And we were very poor. But I didn't know we were poor, Diane, because all of my neighbors lived the way I did. And we had plenty to eat, and things didn't cost a lot of money then.
Right.
And so, you know, I enjoyed my life and never knew I was poor until later.
Did your parents express love for you?
Totally. I'm not one of those guys who had a bad relationship with his mother or father. I love them. We were close-knit. I'm an only child, I think, because we lived in one room. We lived in a one-room apartment with a kitchenette for most of my first 20 years. Kitchenette, one bathroom. I used to walk to school, walk home. Okay. Where did you grow up?
Right here in
Washington. In the D.C. area.
Walked to school through a high school, no college.
Mm-hmm.
Began here as a volunteer.
Okay.
And now it's all over.
By the grace of God.
By the grace of God. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning, Robert. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Mr. Friedkin, I've been a huge fan of your work for many years, particularly things like To Live and Die in L.A. And
thank you.
Sure. My question, though, is regarding a lot has been written over the years about The Exorcist, particularly the controversy surrounding casting and screen credit for Mercedes McCambridge and Eileen Dietz, and I wondered if you could discuss some of that.
Yeah. Mercedes McCambridge did the voice of the demon, and when I asked her to do it, she was a great radio actress, and I went to her to do the demon voice because her voice was kind of neither female nor male. It was sort of neutral. She insisted that she not receive screen credit.
Why?
She said that if the film were to be effective, people should believe that this voice was coming from that little girl. And she made it a strong point and didn't have it in her contract. I begged her to take a screen credit because it was a wonderful job of acting. And I so admired her. And she said no. And then the film came out and she completely changed her mind and sought screen credit, which we immediately gave to her. There were only 26 prints around at the time, so in all subsequent print, we replaced the last reel of those 26 prints, which had the credits, and put her credit on after the fact. In terms of Eileen Dietz, she was the Linda Blair's lighting double. She was older. She was in her 20s. Linda was 12. We used Eileen Dietz, who was the same size as Linda Blair, to light the set with her in it. She appears in the film for about 23 seconds, and that's it. She does have screen credit, though, but she certainly did not play that role or anything near it. It was all Linda Blair except for the voice, the demon voice.
Now, here's my question. I have never seen The Exorcist. I was too afraid to see it. Should I see it?
I think it's a film that transcends the idea of a horror film. It is about the mystery of faith. It's very powerful, but yes, it's disturbing, Diane. And if you don't want to expose yourself to that sort of thing, it will disturb you. I know this for many years. It's been out there for 40 years. And it's coming back again, so you'll have the chance. It'll be back in theaters starting late this fall. So you will have the chance, but if you're disturbed by that sort of thing, this will disturb you more than anything of its kind.
I want to read you a great email from Jeff before we close.
Mm-hmm.
He says, I want to tell you about an experience my mother had seeing The Exorcist. She went to see the film in the theater. During one particularly scary scene, the whole audience screamed, and something fell into my mother's lap that made her scream even more. Apparently, the woman in the seat in front of her screamed so loudly, her wig flew off and landed in the seat behind.
I find that rather sad, disturbing, and somewhat humorous, I'm afraid to admit.
William Friedkin. He's written a new memoir. It's titled The Friedkin Connection. What a joy to talk with you.
My pleasure. Everything I expected and more.
Thank you so much. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.